Hello, everyone, and a very pleasant good afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash welcoming you to a very special Yom HaShoah edition of Inside Track, where we will revisit our 2015 interview with Bill Kugelman about his captivity and liberation from German death camps. Listen closely to Bill's fascinating story. Also, listen for the familiar voice of this show's founder, Emil Franzi.
You know, for those of you who are paying any attention, this is a pretty special week, a celebration of sorts that we have, this being Victory in Europe Day, plus 70. It was 70 years ago this past week that the war officially ended in Germany, American and Allied troops having won that war, a war that saw the art and the science of killing both military personnel as well as some 50 million civilians in Europe, as well as throughout Asia and Africa and the rest of the world. We certainly have fought a few more wars since then, but probably none quite like that have occurred since, and hopefully none will.
No, Bruce, because we actually won that one.
Well, we did win that.
Because we decided we were going to win that one. It was called unconditional surrender.
Okay. Yeah. I know that a lot of us think of the Second World War, and we look at it from the prism of us being Americans. Our mothers and fathers, our grandparents may have fought in that war, had lived through that war period, the sacrifices that families made, the ultimate sacrifice that many families did with their sons and daughters who lost their lives in that great struggle. But as we celebrate VE Day plus 70 years, I wanted you all who listen to this show, and those of you who maybe are new listeners to the show, I wanted you to maybe have an experience, the ability to listen to how that war went from somebody who actually was in the war, but wasn't a combatant in the war, didn't wear a uniform as such, somebody who lived in Europe and was affected by the war and by the brutality and the horror-filled acts of the Nazi regime, Adolf Hitler and his henchman, somebody who went through the camps and who managed to survive and has a view of life that I don't think I've ever met anybody quite like Bill Kugelman, who is our guest here in the 1 o'clock hour here on Inside Track. Bill, welcome to the show. If you just kind of get close to the microphone, we'll be able to hear. Say hello to everybody throughout Southern Arizona.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Thanks.
I'm honored.
Well, our
on this day,
the honor is ours, sir,
to be part of the celebration and the tribute to the American Armed Forces.
Thank you. Bill just celebrated his 91st birthday. I've known Bill, I guess, for probably 20 years or so. We've traveled together on trips to Israel, and Bill has been a volunteer in this community for many years in the schools, and also more recently at the university level, talking about the experience of his family and himself through what has been referred to in common culture as the Holocaust. Lots of people refer to that word in different ways, but this is a man who actually lived through that period. And Bill, if I could, maybe the best way to start is, what was your life like before the war? Where did you live, and how did you and your family live their lives?
Well, I was born on the Polish-German border, in southwest Poland and southeast Germany, about 15 miles away from the actual border. And my parents were shoe manufacturers from generations back. In other words, their parents and so forth were in the shoe manufacturing business.
And what town or city did you live
in? The name of the town was Sosnowiec. Sosnowiec. And my parents were shoe manufacturers, as I said, and they also owned a shoe retail store. On my other side of the family, there were landowners. My great-grandfather was a gentleman farmer. And
would you describe your life as middle class?
I would say upper middle class. We were quite well off.
And the size of your town, was it large or small?
Was about, like when I came to Tucson, was about 120,000 population. But it was an industrial town. It had coal mines, iron ore processing plants, and some other manufacturing going on. In other words, it was rather an industrial town.
And you lived in the city itself?
In the city, in the heart of the city.
Yeah. And you had brothers and sisters?
There were four children. My oldest brother, a sweetheart of a boy. It was a redhead. And then my sister, which lives, a 93-year-old beauty, which lives in Florida. And then there was the youngest one that's gone already. And I was there in between the two of them. I was a 15-year-old boy, a high school kid, that when the war broke out, my beginning of the war, I took it like any other kid. Okay, it was an adventure, but soon enough, it became a house of horrors. They used to grab us from the street, young people, and make us do work for them, for the German authorities, like cleaning the streets, cleaning their offices, cleaning their facilities. And then they let us go home after we finished without as much as a thank you. If something wasn't the way they liked it, they used to give us the end of the rifle butt or a whip that they carried around quite frequently with them. How did they know that we were Jews? A week or two, I don't remember exactly, after the war started, which they occupied Poland within 3 weeks, all of it. Within a week or two, they have distributed through a setup, naturally using free labor, in other words, Jews, they distributed coupons for food, for clothing, for whatever you need. And we had to wear a Star of David on our clothing, which had to be very visible.
That was the yellow Star of David, white Star of David?
The yellow.
Yeah.
And that's how they recognized a Jew. And God forbid if they caught you and you didn't have that star on you. That was a straight road to a concentration camp.
Now, I know before the war, you obviously had religious freedom. Your family celebrated holidays and so on. I know that Passover was always a big holiday in your family.
Every holiday was. Jewish culture in Poland was on par on the Polish. Some people claim that it surpassed. They had newspapers in Yiddish. They had theater. They had literature. They had writers. Everything that was any country or any culture develops the Jewish population. Poland's Jewish population had it. In other words, there was a fully organized way of living.
Welcome back to Inside Track. It's a special program celebrating the 70th anniversary of victory in Europe. If any of you didn't remember that date, I'm old enough to barely do so as a kid.
Yeah, your brother fought in the
Second
World War.
My brother was there. Yeah, about that time he was just parking his tank, or his tank company, as the case may be.
He might have been.
By then he was a first sergeant for a tank company.
Whereabouts was he? Was he in France?
He probably would have been going into Germany because he was over on that Alsatian front. It started out with the 3rd Army, but ended up in the 7th under Patch. That much I know because I remember being told the story several years later. And even though I would have been about 8 when he came home a couple years after the war, you never forget that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, we're here with Bill Kugelman. And Bill, we were talking about before the war started still, and I know from talking with you previously that the holidays were a big thing in your family, the Jewish holidays, and Passover was an especially big holiday.
Absolutely. Passover is a very symbolic holiday. It's a holiday where you celebrate freedom. And this was a big, big thing in Europe. It was going on till past midnight, the celebration in most homes, I would say. I cannot vouch for everybody, but most homes, it was that was the culmination of celebration of the year.
And probably in those days you had plenty to eat. It was like a feast.
Yes.
And
listen,
kids were drinking wine and with the parents.
Absolutely. It's prescribed that you should have 4 jiggers of wine. But we had everybody helped himself, and kids were used to drinking a few goblets of wine. Somehow, nobody got ever hurt from it.
And that changed a lot in September of 1939.
Absolutely.
For you and your family. And it didn't take long, it sounds, before the Nazis had more or less taken over everyday life.
Absolutely. Right away, within the first week, they took over businesses.
Including your family's?
Our business and our home. And we were with my 2 aunts, and each had, 2 of them had 4 children, and 1 had 2 children. And we were all hustled in to 1 room that must have been 15 by 18, maybe. And those 3 families lived like that. And
was that in a ghetto sort of?
That
like
was
absolutely. Ghetto?
We were the first week. There was a curfew. You couldn't get out of the house. And
day and night curfew, or just
No. During the day, there was a certain area where you could move around in. And then they cleaned out the town. I'm jumping ahead. But the idea was that they put it down a curfew within a certain limited. They gathered the Jews that lived outside this area into this to that limited area. And naturally, they took away our, first of all, I was out of school. There was no schooling anymore. My parents lost everything that they owned. All they could do is bag full of clothing, and they hustled us in to a ghetto. That's where three families lived in one room.
And it was the Jews who actually had to construct the walls of the ghetto to keep...
Absolutely. All the work, the only thing the Germans did was stood there, holler, or hit, or shot. They wouldn't do the work. They were in uniforms. And we were, they gathered us, and naturally the rations that they gave us were like a slice of bread, about 3/4 of an inch thick. That was your daily ration. Plus, you were given, later on, while we were in the ghetto, we were given
like a thing of soup, or
no? We were given rice, not rice, but whatever kind of grain,
some sort of grain,
and potatoes and stuff like that. Rice was not available. A meager diet, in other words.
And you were headed into the winter. September 1st, yes, 1939 was the attack, and now you're headed into cold weather, rainy, snowy weather.
Right, and Poland gets pretty cold. But we had clothing. We had clothing that we brought with us. Now, the ghetto was, I was in the ghetto a short while. Then I was taken to the camps. In the camps, we were given the same slice of bread, a cup that they call coffee, which was not coffee at all, was some kind of chemical. Now you wouldn't want to look at it, much less drink it. You wouldn't want to put your nose to it.
And how did you been to that restaurant?
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to even put your nose.
I got you.
So how, when you were taken from your community,
yeah,
how did you get to this first work camp, and about how many miles was it from your home?
The first work camp was not too bad. A kid that was not used to farm work, I became a farmer. And I was young. What was I by then? Maybe 16 years old. And I could take the punishment. And I worked at the farm. This took about a little over a year. And then we were sent to Auschwitz.
When was that?
By the way, I have to retract. When they took us from our homes into the ghetto, they segregated out all women and children, old people, sick people, people that could not, that were not in good shape.
And where did they go, Bill?
They went to the crematoria. They went to the gas chambers.
Was that your mother and your sister?
No. My mother was a young woman yet. She was in her late 30s.
Right.
And she was well built. And my sister was a young lady. By that time, she's older than me. And we were all taken to work camps, to labor camps. And that's where...
And this is doing work for German industry.
Oh, yeah.
As slaves.
Listen, we replaced, like, for instance, I worked on a farm. I replaced the men that went to
war. Yeah, sure. Sure.
I couldn't do the work that he did. He was, a schooled farmer,
right,
so to say. He knew what to do.
And your treatment when you were working on this farm, was it fair or bad? Or?
Fair. What would you call? How can a slave be fair?
Right.
What's fair about it? Hmm. You weren't fed. You weren't. The idea was not to keep you going.
And your brothers, were they working on the same farm with you?
They had other kind of work, whatever work there was. You know, they're all physical work. We didn't sit in an office to push a pen. It was all hard labor.
All right, good time to take a break.
Inside Track will be right back.
Thank you, Harry. This is Bruce Hash along with Bill Kugelman. Celebrating a different perspective to victory in Europe, plus 70. Harry, that song does it to me every time I listen to it. It makes me cry and laugh kind of all at the same time. Bill, we're sort of on this chronology. You've been working with your brothers and your mom and your sister close by in a work camp within a relatively near distance to your hometown. And now, after working there for a while, you are transferred to a camp that is synonymous with most of the world as a death camp, Auschwitz. Can you describe your life there, how long you were there?
Well, until now, we wore our own clothes. We kept ourselves nice and neat. I tried to keep the clothes in good order. When we came there, they stripped us naked. They segregated out again. They picked out the sick and the weak ones. And they naturally, in one of them was the big shot there was the infamous Mengele, and he with the flip of his finger, your life was either either to life or to the chambers, to the gas chambers. He just moved his finger, that's where you went. Well, naturally, from our group that came out of that camp, quite a few people were sent to the gas chambers. Naturally, we were separated from women. We didn't go together. There were women camps and men camps. And then in Auschwitz, we stayed there for a while. By the way, while we were there, there were burning gypsies. I wasn't too close to them, so I didn't hear it. But they say that they pushed them in to ditches and burned them alive. Hmm. Because the crematoria couldn't keep up. They couldn't keep up with burning the corpses, so they pushed them into ditches and burned. And the smell was unbelievable. You had a headache. You could see the smoke coming up, both from the ditches and from the smokestacks.
But we think of the Holocaust, we think of the terms of 6 million Jews, but there were so many others that made the list,
That's
too.
That's correct.
And the gypsies were part of it.
Absolutely. There were a lot. First of all, they burned all the political undesirables. Politically, if you were against Hitler, they sent you to Auschwitz. Number one. Then they took the Polish intelligentsia, believe it or not, and a lot of priests among them, priests that wouldn't preach. It wouldn't follow his line, that were not sympathetic to the Nazi school, to Nazi ideology. Those priests were taken to Auschwitz and they were sacrificed. And that was, but that they were before even they started burning Jews.
Bill, you were a teenager. Just a young man and working hard, trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
Did you believe you were going to make it through this? Did you see an end game to this, or did you think that you were going to lose your life there?
My friend, if I overanalyzed the situation I was in, I wouldn't be here. The reason I survived is because I was young, I was lucky, I wasn't too bright. I didn't analyze, I just lived like an animal. Today, now, I didn't think of tomorrow. There was no tomorrow. That you lived was another winner, another day won.
So you were transferred soon after you'd worked at Auschwitz. Now you're probably wearing the uniforms.
In Auschwitz, they took away our clothing, shaved all our hair, as I said, and made us parade naked in front of, and he picked the survivors, and they tattooed us. From that moment on, you did not have a name, you had a number. I still have one on my arm. Now, what that did to you is they gave you rags to wear instead of your clothing. And that, you felt that you, a ball of trash, and that's what you looked like. And draped in rags and looking starved out, and you didn't look like a human being.
What did they make you do all day?
I worked we built a humongous hangar. An underground hangar. I don't know if you were in a turquoise,
mine
pit,
yeah.
In a turquoise mine in a pit. You look down into that pit, you see those tremendously big trucks. They look like toys. That's how big this project was. There were tens of thousands of people. The camp that I was in was one of, our camp was number 11. Imagine how many camps that were like this. How was the work? We, within a, I would say, we came 3,000 men came into the camp within maybe a half a year. There were a few hundred left. They had to resupply during this time. And they kept on resupplying more people to so we could so there should be a sufficient number of us.
And was it still in the Auschwitz complex, or had you moved on to Landisberg by then?
That was in Landisberg.
Landisberg didn't get any better, did it?
It was much worse. Over there, in Auschwitz, if you survived the selection, you had a chance. If you went to Kaufering, they didn't try an animal. If you want him to do work for you, you feed him, you treat him humanely. They didn't care if we survived. The way we were treated was, you might as well die. You saved them money. They dug a big pit, and they kept on throwing in the corpses. People died out.
Bill, when you went to Landisberg, how did you get there? Was it by rail, or did you walk? Or
that's a good question. We went by rail, cattle cars, yeah. We went by cattle car, and they put in 120 people into one car. You were comfortably standing there. And we got loaf of bread. That was something unbelievable. The trip from Auschwitz, which was in Poland, to Landsberg-Kaufering near Dachau, should have taken less than a week. It took several weeks. When we came to the place where we were supposed to stay, we emptied the load and threw out all the corpses all the death that occurred during our travels. People died during that time.
What percentage do you think of your?
I would be lying if I give you a number, yeah. Honestly. It was substantial. Mm-hmm. Right then and there, we knew. We came into the camp. It was ankle deep in mud, and all we had was a ditch. They built. They made ditches that were 3 by 3, 40 feet long, and an 8 roof on top of it. In other words, what we slept was on the ground.
So there are no walls or anything?
No, what kind of walls?
You kind of slept underneath
and
the shelter.
And they roofed, yeah. Just
you know
like in the
farm. What was when you got to that camp?
Big pond?
What year would it have been when you got to that camp?
43. I think 43. That was 43.
Okay, so you got 2 more years to go.
A year and a half.
Yeah. A year and a half. We got to take a break. We'll be back.
Two years. You're right.
Yeah, okay.
Welcome back to Inside Track. This is Bruce Ash along with Emil Franzi and our special guest for the rest of this hour, Bill Kugelman, celebrating this Victory in Europe Day plus 70 years. Bill, you and your brothers have now come to Landisberg.
Kaufering.
Kaufering, and you're in a work camp, and you're in these incredibly horrific situations. Both of your brothers contract typhoid fever. Can you talk about their experiences?
Yeah, well, my oldest brother, he was really an angel of a human being. And this poor guy, they with typhoid, the stronger you are, the harder it hits you. And he succumbed to the disease. I was so I don't know. I was so scared that I didn't have the heart to go and witnesses to give him a burial. I let them take him and throw him into the pit with all the others. And that is one of my saddest memories of the war. There we were for, we were freezing in that camp, something awful. It was a harsh winter. I remember ripping out the inside of cement bags, the paper from the inside, and cover the my body with one of the, with those sheets of paper. And we had to be very careful, do it on a sneak, because if a guard saw you, he'd give you a rifle butt right in the head. You're stealing government issue. Now, people were dying by the drove of disease and hunger. And it was a rough time we had.
They were working you to death.
Yeah. The idea was not to get how much work they can get out of us, but the work that you did was to kill you. You weren't fed enough to do the work that you had to do. And you froze to death, and you didn't rest enough. Then they took us to, the war was ending, obviously, so they started moving us, but then they were taking us on a march. They did that in a lot of camps. Some of them, they took them out somewhere and shot them. Shot all the people. In other camps, like in ours, they took us and they stopped on the middle of the road after a day or two, and they packed us, they pushed us into a, to a, must either been a big hall, it was a big hall, a very large hall, with a cement floor, and they put us there, and we got up the next morning. One of the guys came in yelling, "They're gone.
The Germans left.
The Germans left. We were lucky they didn't shoot us all."
And how long was it from that time when the German officers left?
Within a couple of hours.
Is when
a couple
allies...
of GIs came in.
Mm-hmm.
And the bundles of rags, because that's what we looked like, bundles of rag. We crawled up to them and started kissing their dirty boots, because they came in from the road. They were kissing them. Oh, if I was a soldier, I'd run out. It was scary to look at us. And that's how we greeted the U.S. Army. Had it taken another week or two, I would have been dust. I wouldn't have been here.
So now you're in the custody, if you will, of the United States Army or Allied troops.
Yes, and they tried to keep us in the camp there, in that hall. Why? Because they felt that we'll spread disease all through Germany, all through Europe. By the way, on the way, on the march, my kid brother, which was 6'2½", was a skeleton. He was so emaciated that it could see every bone on its ribcage. And he sat down in the middle of a rock on a rock. He was marching next to me. And I to look around, he's not there. So I go back and I call him. He's on a rock in the middle of the road. So I said, Joe, for God's sake, they'll shoot you. So he turns to me and spreads his arms. I can't walk. So we grabbed him, me and somebody else helped me, and we marched him to the front of the line. And that's the way he made it to the place where we stayed and where we got to meet the first American GI.
So how did you make it to America?
I lived in Sweden. My sister and mother were liberated from Ravensbrück. They were liberated. My mother was a young woman when she got into, when the war started. And they were liberated by Folke Bernadotte, a Swedish prince. The Swedes took them in to do right by the Allied forces.
And eventually all of you were reunited. Was it in Sweden?
Sweden. Then my mother had siblings in America. A matter of fact, one of her siblings was right here in Tucson. Her brother. And they sent us, her uncle and siblings sent us visas. And we came to America, to New York. Go ahead.
So we only have, unfortunately, a couple of minutes. This has flown past. Do you hold animosity against the Germans?
I learned one thing in life. Hatred is a venom. One person that hates has the venom inside of him. The result, I saw what hatred makes people do. I hate no one. If anything, I get pleasure out of humanity.
The people who deny that the Holocaust existed?
Well, I'll tell you, they're apt to get into more trouble than they realize because of their feelings. There is something about somebody that has such hatred that they deny their own existence.
Bill Kogelman, thank you so much for spending time with us here today.
Too bad I cannot tell you more about what I am doing to honor the GIs that made me free, that made me live all these years.
Well, you know, we'll have
I don't have the time to expend
we'll make
on
time, another time, my friend.
We'll make time. There's a lot of good things that you're still doing at 91, and that you'll be doing at 92 years old. Happy birthday to you! Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor, sir.
You're a mensch.
The pleasure is mine.